This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
This is Tyrese Campbell and you're listening to the Every Step Along the Way podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of Every Step Along the Way. Now, we have a very special guest joining us today. Before we introduce him and meet him, Mike, are you looking forward to the next sort of hour or so, or however long we can sort of pin our guest down for?
No, 100%. I think some people have probably heard bits about the individual we've got tonight, and obviously things such as like the FSA, and I think this man's been involved in pretty much everything Stoke City, I think, over the years. So yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of different avenues that this is going to go down, but yeah, it should be an interesting hour.
Yeah, I feel like we're going to learn a lot here in the next, especially the first half of this podcast. And then we're going to hear some great tales, hopefully, in the second half. So, yeah, if anyone hasn't guessed, I mean, I imagine you probably have done, because it's probably in the title of the podcast you clicked on. But, yes, our person joining us today is Malcolm Clark. Good welcome to the podcast, Malcolm.
Very pleased to be here.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about a range of things, aren't we? But I suppose, first of all, I want to sort of get, for anyone who doesn't sort of know about yourself, do you want to sort of introduce yourself and you know, you people may know that you've sort of chaired the FSA and the FSF, you've been on the FA council, but just sort of give a bit of a background as more sort of meat on the bone for people.
Yeah, sure. I'm obviously a lifelong Stoke City fan. I've been chair of the Football Supporters Association, as it now is, previously the Football Supporters Federation, extraordinarily, as it now seems, since the turn of the century. So that's 24 years, which is probably long enough for anybody, really. And I will probably be standing down from that finally in the summer. And I was also the first supporter representative on the FA Council, which I joined in 2007, stayed on it for 14 years until I had to stand down because I reached the 75-year age limit that they have on the FA Council. That was quite an interesting time. Peter Coates was on it for quite a lot of that time as well. So, yeah, football supporters movement has been very much part of my life for quite a long time now.
So, yes, as you can imagine, people, I think we've got plenty to talk about with Malcolm, haven't we, tonight, from obviously what he's just said there. And, you mentioned there you're probably going to be stepping down from your position of FSA chair. Is that sort of why you maybe look towards setting up the Stoke City supporters group? Because I know that's something that's coming in, isn't it? Over, you know, hopefully be up and running over the summer. Is that like a new direction that you wanted to go in, or would that have happened anyway?
Well, I think it would probably have happened anyway, but you're right that if I was remain very involved in a detailed way, I will have a bit more time for Stoke City things than I have had for many years now. I'm decided to probably stand down, partly because of the old adage, the time to go is when people say, why are you going, rather than thank God for that. I think in any organisation, you know, some churn and some turnover is not a bad thing. We now have 3-year terms of office in the FSA, and if I stand again, it would take me up to 81, believe it or not. And so it just felt like probably the right time to stand down. But certainly, as you say, if it may give me a bit more time to devote to Stoke City issues, which won't necessarily be a bad thing, I hope.
Yeah, and I mean, am I right in thinking that we're the only club without a sort of a central supporters club at the minute?
Pretty well, I think, in the Championship. And certainly there aren't many that haven't. The supporters club became inactive when COVID arrived. And for various reasons, including a lot of resignations from the committee, hasn't really got going again post-COVID. We haven't had at Stoke the kind of things that sometimes act as a catalyst for supporters' organisations to really get very active. You know, if there's bad changes of ownership or threatened to the threats to the club or massive price increases or any of these things, we haven't had at Stoke. And so it's never really got going again. And that is, I think, a big omission now, particularly with the new regulator coming in and the much greater emphasis on fan engagement than we've had before. And they're trying to rectify that and get the supporters club active again as a proper representative organisation.
Just sort of think about the sort of the key questions there. I mean, it would, judging off what you said there, would it be right in saying that the club is it's a good thing to have? It's sort of a break glass in case of emergency kind of scenario. Yeah, like say season ticket come out, they've doubled in prices. The supporters club are there to sort of go, hang on a minute, this isn't fair, and sort of liaise with the club. Would that be sort of the reason for having it?
Well, things like that can suddenly arise and create a lot of anger among supporters. And so it is, for that reason, a good idea to have a proper organisation to represent the fans. But even if something like that doesn't happen, it's important that fans have a dialogue with the club about the direction of the club, what the owners have in mind, how they see the future. And as you two guys know as well as I do, we've had quite a lot of criticism this season about poor performances on the field and whether the ownership of the club has got a proper strategic direction worked out. And all of those kind of things are the things which, under the new arrangements, clubs are expected to consult and talk with supporters about. So it is important that we have the arrangements in Stoke that enable that to happen.
Yeah, I think it's always good, isn't it, for... I think it's a good two-way thing there. The owners can sort of keep the finger on the pulse and their expectations, if you like, both on and off the field. And also the supporters, like I say, have got a good voice and there's them lines of communication and information can sort of drip down as well, can't it, to the wider supporter base from the group.
Yes, yes. And it's important that the people who speak on behalf of the supporters have got mechanisms to go back to the people who put them there, if you like, to get a mandate to report back and see what people think. I wouldn't make any criticism at all of the people who've served on the Supporters Council over the years. And indeed, I did myself for the first couple of years, although that seems a long time ago now. But you've got to have a body, I think, to report back to and take a mandate from, so that we don't just have a situation where people are elected to roles, but then haven't got anywhere they can report back to. So that's the basic reasoning for it. And in the new arrangements, as I say, there will be a requirement for clubs to undertake such consultation. And in fact, the recommendation is that if there is a proper democratic supporters organisation, that it should have a place on the fan engagement mechanisms. And so it's important that we do that at Stoke, just as they have at many other clubs.
Mentioned there that you served on the Supporters Council. I mean, Mike, if I just bring you in, you also served sort of a term, didn't you, on the Supporters Council?
Yeah, exactly. I served on there right until the very end of it, actually, in its latest form. And like, I, you know what, when I was on the council, I did feel, especially, to be honest, when Tony Scholes left, I felt like there's Simon King came in and he really listened. And I think it was actually better than I originally expected. I kind of expected to go in there and it was a lot of maybe a lot of lip service and stuff like that from the club, and they just want to just sit in a room, listen to you, and never actually act on anything. And I think, in credit to the club, from my, you know, my perspective and my experience was, you know, especially as I say, when Tony left and Simon came in, they really did seem to care about what people thought and the feedback. And there was a number of things that the club did. And I guess what I'm trying to understand about any new structure going forward, I think my opinion is, yes, it's great to have that two-way conversation, but is there ever going to be like a, well, I suppose there's never going to be a compulsion on the owners to actually act on anything. And I suppose it's always good to have the communication, but the final decision will probably always be down to the club and what they want to do. I know people have talked about having somebody on a board, you know, an unofficial member of the board and stuff like that. I mean, will it ever be any more than just two-way conversation and the owners have to decide, or will that individual on a body of some kind have more power than maybe they've had before, do you think?
Well, certainly the intention of the reforms that are now coming in with the independent regulator are that supporters should have a much greater voice than they have done in many clubs over the years. Obviously, at the end of the day, it will still be the owner's decisions on certain key issues. But it's important that supporters have the information on which to make a judgment about it. The other point perhaps I should have made as well is that there's also the national dimension to this, that it's important at the FSA's national level that we have affiliates really at every club that can actively feed back to us. And for many years now, I've been the only Stoke City supporter who has been actively involved at all at the national level. Monica Hartland, Surrey Stokey on the message board in years gone by, certainly played a very important role. But it's been a bit lacking at that level. So it's not just about talking to Stoke City. I think it's about playing a part in the national discussions as well.
Yeah, because I think that like I say, that's important as well, isn't it? That football fans, you know, we might be lucky in people may judge us from the outside, or even Stoke fans inside, and think, you know, the Coates family, we're in safe, whatever you think of the on-field stuff, like the clubs and safe fans, we're never going to be sort of cast aside, or, you know, they'll write off X amount of millions, et cetera, et cetera. You know, spend money on infrastructure wherever they can. But there's other clubs who aren't that lucky. And you also don't know in football how quickly things can change, can you? And ownerships can change and everything. So it is, like I say, just because we're, you know, going through a good time in that respect, that doesn't mean that years down the line we will be experiencing some of the things that are maybe happening at other clubs right now.
I think that's certainly true, Daniel. And one of the most dangerous things that any football supporter can ever utter, I think, it could never happen here. We think it won't happen at Stoke, but that doesn't mean that no problems could arise in the future. And it's also important that, as you say, that all clubs who've got fans have got a common interest should work together. I tend to say that what we have in common is football supporters is far more important than the club rivalries, much though we can get worked up about those sometimes. But football fans all over the country are basically very similar and with similar objectives. And we all need to have a healthy football pyramid with viable clubs in it that are not going bankrupt or whatever. So we've got a lot of common interests on the national scene as well, and it's important that Stoke fans play their part in that as much as anybody else.
I think you nailed that, to be honest, Malcolm. I think regardless of whether you support Stoke, Vale, Crewe, bloody Nantwich Town, it makes no difference. At the end of the day, you support the club you support, and you know the financials really don't. You just want a club to support. It's simple as that, don't you? They might not be the most successful club in the world. They might not be the richest. You know, you may never see success as a club, but like you don't want to end up in a Bury situation where you literally lose your club that you've loved all your life. And I think it's just really important there's a club there, and you accept the highs and lows, but that is just football.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think like all pyramids, the football pyramid is only as strong as its base. And there's a lot of focus very often on the top of the pyramid and the big clubs and the profile that they have. But the English football pyramid is unique, really. And we mustn't ever put it at risk. And we've seen clubs of different sizes have problems that the fans have had to work to fight against. Right at the top, the fans of the Big Six fought against the European Super League, and that could yet reappear. Whereas at the other end of the scale, as you say, you can have clubs who are fighting for their very existence, or owners who assets strip the ground or whatever it is. So what unites us is far important than the club rivalries, in my view.
I was going to bring this up later, but now seems a good time to sort of touch on it. I mean, there's been a lot of said this week about the scrapping of FA Cup replays. And I one thing I can't get around is, why is that happening from round one? Because the clubs involved don't even come until round three anyway. It's like, and I think it's disgusting really that the FA and the Premier League have seemed to have made that decision without any consultation of probably 98% of the teams who partake in the FA Cup. And they've just decided this is the way we're going to go.
Well, you raise a good point there about rounds one and two. We had a special meeting of our FSA council the night before last, and one of the very clear points that we made was that even if you accept the difficulties of the international calendar as causing replays in later rounds to be difficult, there doesn't seem to be any reason at all why they can't be retained in the first two rounds. The first two rounds proper, that is. There's even talk now, because they want consistency through the competition, that they might think about abolishing them in the preliminary rounds as well, which I think a lot of our member clubs would be totally opposed to as well. This problem is created by the international calendar. and just finding the space within it. We said a long time ago that if the European Champions League was expanded, that it would lead to this kind of problem. That's the root cause of the problem. But we'll continue to do all we can to protect what I think most fans regard as the heritage and attractiveness of the FA Cup, and certainly getting them to review rounds one and two replays would be part of that.
I think there's some people who think that one of the things that obviously a consultation would have done was obviously throw up different ideas, and I think there was a few people that I've spoken to who mentioned a couple of alternatives, like if, say, Man City didn't want to be involved because they've got Champions League and all these different things, then they have the option to opt out before the start of the season. They have the option to not be involved at all. Obviously, another idea was, well, they could have just sent down the younger players, the youth players, which I think personally would probably degrade the cup, which I think the FA Cup's always had that gravitas over, say, the Carabao Cup, which I wouldn't be a big fan of that, if I'm honest. I think we'd lose the magic of the FA Cup if that happened. But I think at least, as you say, if there was an open conversation with everyone concerned, then they could throw ideas like that around. And just to, like Dan says, I think to make the decision for everybody else when... It doesn't affect them for large portions of it, and if it does, these clubs have got big enough teams, surely, that they can just put a half decent team out. And if they don't care about it, then they've got nothing to lose. But I it's very bad how they've gone about it.
Yes, I mean, it's not my role in life to speak on behalf of the FA, but they might say that. The Football League were represented on the Professional Game Board and the FA Board, which took these decisions, which they are. The group that isn't directly represented on those bodies is supporters. Had we been more closely involved in the discussions, we would have made many of those points. You may remember that years ago, there was quite a scandal when Manchester United were allowed to withdraw from the FA Cup because I think were they playing in the World Championship final or something? Yeah. What I think fans would like to see is the top clubs participating, with a decent side as well, because that's part of the attraction of it.
When these clubs spend £400 million on players, I think they've got more than enough to have a B and a C squad, really, haven't they? They've got very little excuse for that.
Yes, yes. I think it's an interesting conversation as to how many fans would be happy if too many of the Premier League clubs did start fielding B. Well, of course, we always have already have their youth, younger teams, don't we? In what we used to call the Autoglass, didn't we? Whatever it's called now, the lower leagues competitions, and that's created a bit of adverse comment. But I think the key point about all these issues is, as you said, let's have a proper dialogue, and fans should be very much at the centre of that discussion, rather than as we so often are, we end up. Having to oppose something or run a campaign against it after, if in effect, the decision has been taken. And there's a lot of lip service given to the importance of fans, but that doesn't always translate into actually involving fans' reps in the discussions before the decisions are taken. And this is probably a classic example of that.
Yeah, I think my sort of two points there, I think, on this, and they are very, even thinking in my head, I know they're very black and white and don't maybe cover the grey areas. But number one is, if you don't want to replay, make sure you don't draw the first match. Go out and win it. No. And the second one is, I don't think these clubs in the Premier League have been complaining too much when that European Champions League and competitions have been expanded, and they've got a lot more games there than they will play replays in a season, and they're not complaining about those games too much, are they, coming along, because they'll earn them a lot more money.
That is the root cause of the problem. The expansion of the European competition has created the problem for the football calendar. There's no doubt about that at all. And we did warn them. But as you say, unfortunately, that is regarded as something which is more important than the traditions of the FA Cup, which is a great shame.
Do you think as well? I mean, we'll move back onto the sort of the Stoke supporters group after this. But do you think that's partly due as well to, obviously, I mean, Arsenal, foreign owned, Manchester United, foreign owned, Liverpool, foreign owned. There's no English owners at the top of the game anymore that maybe understand the heritage and the history of a competition like the FA Cup.
I'm sure that's true. Yes, I'm sure that's true. Exactly as you've said, the ownership structures these days are very different from what they were many years ago, when a lot of clubs tend to be owned by the, you know, the local business person who's done well, got a bit of money and is interested in football and has brought the team that he or she has supported all their lives. You know, I remember people like Bob Lord, the Burnley butcher, owning Burnley, and others like that. You could actually argue that in some ways the Stoke owners, the Coates family, are more in that historical mould than most of the owners of the larger clubs these days. They are local owners who have done well in business and have been fans of the local club. So, and I think there's a lot to be said for that. But exactly as you say, particularly at the top of the Premier League, they're not owned by people who've got a deep understanding of the tradition to British football, in my view.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, that you mentioned it there. I mean, we were foreign-owned at a time when that was a really rarity. And yes, now we're yes. Local-owned when it's become a rarity.
That's right. Yes, we had the Icelandic period, and have gone back to the local ownership. And certainly, I wouldn't want to change that. I know I've heard some Stokeists talking about, you know, the club won't do well until the current owners go. It's not a view that I personally share, but there we are.
No, I think I can fairly say that me and Mike as well are both with you with that. I think what for me, you look at what goes on at other clubs, and I know that no matter what decision these owners of this club take, they do it with the best interests of the club at heart. Not for what they think will make them the most money, not for what they think will get them the most publicity or anything like that. They do what they think is best for the club, the supporters, the area, whatever. It's all done in good faith.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, we have to accept the reality. We'd all like to get back in the Premier League as soon as possible, obviously, because you always want your team to do as well as possibly can. The reality, of course, is that if you look through the Championship and indeed below the Championship, you've got big clubs who've been in the Premier League in the past. It's littered with them, actually. And we can't all get promoted. And there's fans all over the country who feel just like we do, that they used to be in the Premier League and they want to get back there. And even at the level below, you know, your Portsmouths, your Boltons, etc. Clubs who've been there. So if you look at the history of Stoke, you know, there have been long periods in the past when we haven't been in the top league. That's just the way it is. We want to get back there. Of course we do. If you regard not getting promoted to the Premier League as a failure, then, you know, I think it's a slightly unrealistic view.
Just sort of going back to where we were before with the, I mean, you talked about the Supporters Council and Stoke are replacing it with something called Stoke Connect, aren't they? How is that, how would that differ from the Stoke Supporters Group that's been set up? Is Stoke Connect more going to be sort of led from inside the club?
Well, Stoke City Connect, as I understand it, will be a body of supporters who will have the responsibility of putting forward the supporters' view. But they will be appointed by a panel of suitable people who I think the club are currently in the process of setting up. So the difference is that they won't be directly elected. Now, the FSA's view is that there should be some element of direct democratic election in any supporters' representative body. And we'll see whether or not the club make any changes to that in due course. But even if they don't, it's still important to have a representative supporters organisation which can feed stuff through to whoever sits on Stoke City Connect. Those individuals have got to have some channel to the wider supporter group. Now, under the club's arrangements, there will be so many fans assemblies each year, which are just open meetings. And so I would expect that the Stoke City Connect members will attend those meetings and take the view from them as one way of finding out what supporters think. But also think that it's important to have a properly structured democratic supporters club, which can also feed into those discussions as well as feeding into the national discussions. So I think all of those components have a role to play.
Brilliant. So with the Stoke Supporters Club then, the Stoke Supporters Group, when are you aiming to get it up and running? And also, what exactly are you looking for? How can people get involved? At what levels are there?
Well, we had a meeting in Ricardo's a week or two ago, which was attended by about 20 people, something like that. And some of those have put themselves forward to do the work to get it set up. But there's still plenty of scope for others coming forward, and particularly people with appropriate skills, you know, on website production, social media, all of those kind of things. So if anybody listening to this is interested, then please get in touch. They can get in touch with me directly through the FSA website or through a message on the OKNet message board. Because there's certainly plenty of work to be done. What I think we'll end up doing is probably having a proper AGM launch, maybe at the beginning of next season, when we can get a properly elected committee and officers in place and get the thing on a proper constitutional footing. But certainly at the moment, if anybody listening to this would like to get involved and do a bit of the work, and particularly if they've got skills in some of those areas, then please step forward. The more the merrier.
Yeah, and if you've joined our sort of Facebook group as well, and your group chat, if anyone's on there and wanted to sort of speak to you on there, we sort of, you joined that this week, didn't you? And if anybody sends anything to us, then we will pass it on to yourself as well. So over the summer, there's going to be roles that need filling. People can, like I say, fill those, get everything gets up and running. What then will the, how will there be members? Do people sort of sign up and become members? Will you look into like a fee for that, or is it just going to be a free service?
There have to be a membership in order to give people the entitlement to vote and nominate other people and that, those things. My personal view is that it won't be necessary, at least in the short term, to have a membership fee, because the one thing that the supporters club is actually not short of is a little bit of cash. There's some money in the bank, which has been sitting there not doing any work for supporters, which it should be. What we've been short of is people rather than money. So my personal view is it probably won't be necessary to have a membership fee, at least in the first few years. But actually, that wouldn't be my decision. That would be a decision for the new organisation itself.
Yourself, Malcolm, and sort of like say your history, you sort of when you introduced yourself at the beginning, you said, you know, it's like it was a quarter of a century you've now been sort of chair of the Football Supporters Federation that then merged, I believe, in 2018, merged with another organisation to become the, is it the Football Supporters Association now? You, like I say, to have such a long period in charge of, really, the voice of the fans of the game. I mean, I'm sure you'll sort of say, you know, you may choose to like sort of play it down, but for me, whenever anything comes up, you are the, you know, say we, you hear your name mentioned when, and you know, you are the go-to person, the spokesman for such a massive body of people, haven't you, for such a long time?
Yes, it's funny, really, because it almost came about by accident. When I had a career change in the late 90s, I went to the annual conference of the Football Supporters Association, as it then was, at Oakwell in Barnsley, because I felt I'd got a bit more time. And before long, almost immediately, I suddenly found myself on the committee, and then I was the vice chair. And in no time, I was the chair. Wasn't something I particularly planned in advance, as it were, but ended up doing it for this length of time, becoming the first ever supporter on the FA Council. And, you know, something which I hadn't intended to happen in that sense almost happened sort of by accident, as it were. But it's been a very interesting time. I think we've achieved quite a bit over the years. In fact, I've been involved in two mergers, because the Football Supporters Association, as it was in the late 90s, merged in 2002 with an organisation called the National Federation of Football Supporters Clubs to produce the Football Supporters Federation. But then a new organisation came on the scene called Supporters Direct, which was an organisation of supporters trusts, when we had the new model for community ownership of football clubs. And so, as you say, in 2018, we merged again to go back to being called the Football Supporters Association. So I've been around during two mergers. It's been the dominant thing in my life in many ways over the last 20 odd years. I think we've done quite well in that time. We now have, I think, 18 staff, whereas most of the time I was involved for a lot of the time, we just had a couple of people working on part-time contracts. So it's expanded as well, and I think we've become even though I say it myself, an effective professional organisation these days.
Yeah, I mean, you've got over 500,000 members now. I mean, that's amazing, really, to think there's, like I said, that many sort of people subscribing and members of the organisation. There's over 300 affiliated groups. I mean, is that sort of numerous ones from various clubs? Or how far down the pyramid does that go?
Well, yes, it is. It goes right the way from the top of the Premier League down into the depths of what we call the national game, the non-league game, effectively. I'm not quite sure what the answer is. What's the lowest placed club in the pyramid where we've got an affiliate support organisation? It's an interesting question. I'll ask the guys in the office about that tomorrow. But basically, yes, it's every level. And of course, sometimes it's at the lower level where clubs have particular difficulties, very often through asset stripping of the ground when the ground is under different ownership from the club. And so that can often be problems. And rogue owners who want to move in for the wrong reasons are often focusing on some of the smaller clubs rather than some of the bigger ones. But yeah, so we get involved at every level. We've had a few successes. I think certainly the reintroduction of proper safe standing areas I'd put down as something that I'm pretty pleased about, really, because we campaign for that for a long time. And of course, Stoke City are one of the clubs that are now going to do that as well. The new regulator that was debated in Parliament on Tuesday, which is coming in, is an important development as well that we've argued for, because we think that the game has proved that on many key areas it's incapable of regulating itself.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And giving it a local perspective, there have been things that affected Stoke. I don't know if you remember the problem that we had some years ago when a load of Stokies were compulsorily bussed back from Earlham when we were playing in Manchester, totally illegally. And we took that up, and it eventually won considerable compensation for those Stoke fans. So the casework side of it, when particular individuals or groups of fans are badly treated, is also an important part of our work as well. So even though I say it myself, I think we've made good progress over the years.
Yeah, I think I remember that. Was it Manchester United we were playing, and they got sent back, didn't they, straight back to the train station and forcibly put on a train back to Stoke. And I mean, there was some people on there who weren't even going to Stoke, were they? They weren't even living in Stoke, and they were forced to get on this train back to the Potteries.
Well, yeah, there were actually two incidents. One, exactly as you say, when people were forced to get on a train, and I think actually that may have been after a Bolton game. But the Manchester one, the police put people on a coach and bussed them back to Stoke. There were some disgusting elements to it, like even not allowing people to use the toilet. But basically, it was a completely illegal act, and we took Greater Manchester Police, took legal action against them, and they eventually conceded and paid out compensation. But obviously, the main objective is to have a relationship with the police and an understanding by them that doesn't give rise to the need to do that in the first place. And hopefully those lessons were learned. To be fair to the police, I think they were. I think the policing of football now is better than it, quite a lot better than it used to be, which is a good thing.
Do you think like that those sort of conversations and the actions that you've taken in those circumstances have maybe led to a new way of thinking for the police when it comes to football? So, but you've obviously just alluded there that they now are maybe a bit more understanding of the footballing crowd, if you like.
I think so, yes. We, as fans, you know, and particularly Stoke City fans at one stage, we had a reputation, which may have been in part justified, but certainly not to the extent that some police forces applied it. And it's just a form of discrimination, isn't it? That football fans as a group are regarded negatively sometimes, or the fans of a particular club. I do think the police have improved. There was plenty of scope for improvement, I have to say. Overall, I think, you know, there's a recognition that whilst obviously some fans may sometimes misbehave, that overall football fans are decent people who just want to go out and enjoy the afternoon or the evening watching their team.
That's bang on there. With the independent regulator, and obviously it's something that seems ever more likely to be coming in and coming in soon into British football, is how much interference do you think that's likely to have? Do you think it'll be something that initially there may be a few things that get sorted and then it'll just be sitting in the background ready to sort of act if required? Or do you think there'll be more like visible on a more regular basis?
I think how visible they'll need to be will depend on how the football industry and football clubs comply with the requirements. I suppose it's like any other regulator, really, that if the regulated bodies, which would be predominantly football clubs in this case, adopt the appropriate standards and requirements that they'll be obliged to do, then the regulator won't have such a prominence. And there's a real sense in which we would hope that would be the case. If they don't, then we would expect the regulator to intervene. The overall objective is to have financial sustainability in the game, so that we don't see clubs going to the wall and have their very existence threatened. But also the underlying principle that we were talking about earlier of proper standards of fan engagement, and that certain things can't change without the approval of the fans. You know, we've seen some fairly high profile examples of those kind of things in recent years. You may remember Hull Tigers. The owners decided they wanted to rename Hull City as Hull Tigers. And the Cardiff owner who decided that it would be a good idea for Cardiff City to play in red are things which the fans of those clubs were passionately against. But obviously we hope that, you know, owners will not give the new regulator cause to intervene too often. But, you know, in the real world, I don't think that will be the case. There will be, certainly in the early years, plenty of work for the regulator to do.
Yeah, I mean, that whole Tiger situation, am I right in thinking that sort of the FA, sort of the head of the FA Council and the Football League representative there were quite happy for that change to go ahead? And
well, no, the FA weren't, actually. Spoke in the FA Council against it. That's the FA Council. Some of the leadership of the FA were in favour, but when it went to the council were against it. And there was even the FA Council voted against it, and but the Mr. Alam, the Hull owner, then took action against the FA because he said it, and it was directed at me actually because I'd spoken against it, and they managed to produce a YouTube video of me speaking at the Hull supporters meeting immediately before we played at Hull, and said that I had voted and spoke on this when I hadn't been objective. You know, I'd been influenced. Now, this was a very curious legal notion because obviously I was there to represent the supporters' viewpoint. That's why I was on the FA Council in the first place. And if you then say when somebody goes to a supporters' meeting and listens to those views, if they repeat them, they're not neutral, they're not looking at the evidence, they're just acting as the mouthpiece of the supporters. Yes, I was. That's exactly what I was there to do. So it was a strange legal argument. The judge referred it back to the FA Council. And actually, when the FA Council voted again, the majority against Hull Tigers increased. But that was actually largely because the national game people, the county FAs and the people of the grassroots reps all supported us and the Hull fans. The leadership of the FA and the leadership of the Football League didn't, which was regrettable. But there we were. There we are. We won it in the end.
See, that astounds me that, like you say, the leadership of the FA and the Football League there could be so tone deaf to think that that was acceptable.
Yes, well, the then chair of the Football League, Greg Clark, who then subsequently became the chair of the FA, stood up in the council meeting and said that if an owner wants to change the name of his club, he should be allowed to, which is a fundamental point of disagreement that we had. But we won it in the end, that one. Hopefully, we won't see any other owners choosing to do anything stupid with the club name or the club colours or, you know, other things about the heritage of clubs that supporters find so important.
Yeah, I think Cardiff have got those sort of ring of red seats as a nice constant reminder of the time they were forced to play in red, haven't they?
Yes.
I mean, there's a couple of other instances that you've sort of managed to successfully fend off some quite radical change. And they're quite linked together as well. I mean, we mentioned about FA Cup replays earlier on. There was Game 39, wasn't there? And then, of course, the quickly batted away European Super League as well.
Yes, Game 39 is an interesting one. That came up very, very shortly after I got on to the FA Council. And I remember standing up and making a speech against Game 39. And after the meeting, one of the council members, I didn't know most of them because I'd only just joined, came up to me and shook my hand and said, congratulations on your speech. I agreed with every word of it. You were quite right. So I said, oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you very much. And sort of, who are you? And he introduced himself and said, I'm Major Billy Thompson, the Army representative. And I did a kind of double take because I never had envisaged that I might suddenly have an alliance with the Army on the football matter. So totally unexpected. I was sort of pinching myself and thinking it's a slightly surreal element about this. Yes, and on the European Super League, I mean, to be fair, the fans of those clubs were as vocal and active as any, because the reality is a lot of the ordinary match-going fans of those clubs still appreciate going to Stoke City on a cold Tuesday night, at least as much, if very often more, than they do going to Barcelona or Real Madrid or wherever, even if they could afford to go to those places, which in many cases they probably couldn't.
Do you think that the European Super League, or in it's the guise they presented before, an adapted one, is likely to resurface? I think is it inevitable that it will resurface further down the line?
Well, I think it would be naive to suppose that it definitely wouldn't. One of the interesting things about the European Super League, of course, was that it was that which provoked Boris Johnson to set up the fan-led review by Tracy Crouch, which has led to the new regulator. It was in the Conservatives' manifesto that they would have a fan-led review of football, but they hadn't shown any sign of actually implementing that until the European Super League proposal. So I always say to people, we actually owe the Big Six a great debt of gratitude, because by doing that, they provoked the government into setting up the review, which has finally led to the new regulator. So thanks, guys, for doing that. That's what I say too, to the Big Six, because you've actually ended up causing something which will be good for the whole game.
Yeah, they've shot themselves in the foot, I think, with that one, haven't they, big time?
Yes, absolutely. So.
And, I mean, you've mentioned just obviously your time on the FA Council. Just to reply, you were in there from 2007 till 2021?
That's right, yeah.
And you were the first ever supporters representative after 144 years of the FA Council. So, congratulations on that, I think, first and foremost.
Yes, I mean, if you want an anecdote about that, I went to the first meeting, which was in Jury's Hotel in Soho in London, when the FA was still at Soho Square. And I walked in and I knew absolutely nobody. And I stood around, they were all having coffee. And the first thing I managed to do was spill my coffee all over the white tablecloth that it was being served on. So that was a great start. I put my bag down on the front row and the company secretary came over and said, "Is that your bag on the front row?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Oh, that's reserved for the vice president. Would you mind moving it?" So I thought, oh, this is great, you know, no welcome, no nothing, you know, nobody. But then there was a lovely chap called Ron Barston, who's sadly no longer with us, died last year, who represented Leicestershire, I think. And Ron came over and said, "Are you the new supporter rep?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he shook my hand and said, introduced himself, and I thought, well, at least somebody is welcoming me. And Ron said, "I'll give you a bit of good advice that I was given when I first got onto the FA Council." And I said, "Oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you very much. What's that?" And he said, "Don't say anything for 2 years." So I did a double take, and I actually lasted about 40 minutes. But it sort of said something about the culture of the FA at the time, that when you got on the FA Council, the new boys and girls, not that there were many girls, because there weren't, there were only three women out of 120 when I first got on, that you basically weren't expected to do anything except sit there and learn from your elders for quite a long time. So I was always grateful to Ron for that. Ron, incidentally, used to be once a Football League linesman, and he said to me, "Well, you'll remember," he said, "I was a linesman at the Victoria Ground when I didn't give Richards offside when he scored against you, but I'm he said, "You'll remember that, but he was definitely onside, you know, he was." And I was right. And of course, I haven't got the slightest recollection of this whatsoever. But he assumed that I would remember the details of a goal scored against us many years previously. But he's a lovely fellow, Ron, and I never forgot the way he welcomed me, because nobody else was doing much welcoming. To be fair to the FA, these days they do have a proper induction program for new members, and you know, they do welcome people, I think, in a proper way. But it wasn't like that when I first got on. And I, of course, knew that quite a lot of members of the FA Council had opposed the idea of a supporter being on at all. So
you felt you maybe were up against it from the start then, weren't you? If you were, yeah, there was a few members there who weren't, your role in particular wasn't one that they were welcoming to.
Yeah, you know, that was absolutely absolutely right. But in fairness, I think a lot has changed since then. And, I don't think there'd be anything like as many people now who thought it was a bad idea to have a supporter on the FA Council. I mean, if you're interested in humorous anecdotes, as a council member, you go into the Wembley suite and the Royal Box for the big games, and you can usually bring a guest. And I when England were playing Estonia, I took Nello along as my guest. And the FA chairman, Greg Dyke, welcomed into the Wembley suite the Prime Minister of Estonia and said, you are the first Prime Minister who's been here, you know, since I've been chair. Well, I could see Nello clocking this, and he said to me, Prime Minister, which is the, you know, which one's he? So I pointed him out. So when we all came back in at half-time for the half-time cup of tea, Nello made a beeline for the Prime Minister of Estonia and said to him, he said, Prime Minister, have you seen Marvellous? So the Prime Minister of Estonia looked a little perplexed and said, no, I don't think so. What's that? And Nello said, well, that's a film about me. It's my life story, you see. So the Prime Minister looking a bit perplexed, and Nello said, you mean they haven't yet shown it in Estonia? So it was one of those conversations that afterwards I just deeply regretted that I hadn't been quick enough thinking to get my phone out and record it, because the discussion between Nello and the Prime Minister of Estonia about why they hadn't shown Marvellous in Estonia goes down as one of the great conversations I've ever heard, I think.
Oh, yeah, I mean, we had Nello on here, didn't we, Mike? We spoke to John Rudge, and we had Nello and Rudge in together, and some of the stories, you could say just what a character he is. He's fantastic, isn't he?
Yes, he is, absolutely. And he's out of circulation at the moment, incidentally, because he fell and broke his hip at a circus in Birkenhead some time ago, well, a couple of months ago, and has been confined to barracks ever since. So he's been missing a few games, but hopefully he'll be back in time for the start of next season.
He's not been going around in chicken suits and jumping off the high wires or something, has he?
I don't think it was anything as dramatic as that. I think he just slipped and fell. Hopefully he's doing what the physiotherapist is telling him to, so that he can make... I don't think he'll be back at the ground this season, but hopefully by next season he'll be back to normal.
I really do have these images in my head of Nello on a motorbike going through rings of fire and all this stuff. It's just nothing to surprise you, but it's good to see that he's on the mend anyway.
Yes, well, of course, he's been... You know, a friend of mine since right back since I first went to Kiel in 1964, and he's certainly given me more amusing moments than anybody else I've ever known. And
your life has been more interesting for him being involved in it, I'd think, Malcolm.
Oh, well, yes, absolutely, absolutely. And of course, we put quite a few of the anecdotes about that in the marvellous book. So if you allow me to do a little plug for that, if anybody wants to read a bit more about it, then get the paperback edition of the book. It's on sale in the club shop. So.
Yeah. Oh, it's a fantastic read. And yeah, Nello, if you are listening, if anyone shows this or you're listening, then yes, get yourself well soon and we'll no doubt see you down the ground next season when you're fit and back on your feet again. One person you would have been on the FA Council with was Peter Coates as well, wasn't it? I mean, you have to... I believe that the only reason you left was that you hit the 75-year... When you get 75, you're not allowed to stand on there, are you, anymore? But Peter Coates and yourself would have like been together on the council for a period?
Yes, we were. And, I mean, Pete had to stand down a few years before me for exactly the same reason when he was became 75. And on occasions, we had a bit of an alliance. We used to chat about items that were coming up. And one thing that struck me and actually still strikes me is the great respect with which he was held at national level in the game. When he stood up and spoke, people listened. They respected his knowledge and his wisdom about football. And certainly he and I had plenty of discussions about particular issues that were coming up, and I've always greatly valued his opinion. And even now, people in football, when I bump into them, FA council members and others say, "You know, how's Peter? Have you seen him?" Which, of course, I haven't normally. So. They seem to think that I might know, I might be able to give them sort of up to date information. But a lot of time for his wisdom, really.
Yeah, I think we all go down in this club's sort of history and that, and his partnership with Tony Pulis in particular, one of the duo that they were, obviously, is what sparked the revival of the club and ended 23 years outside the top five. So you'll forever be sort of remembered, like say, in this club's history. A couple of other things. I mean, we're just sort of winding down now. You've been quite sort of vociferous and part of the 20 is plenty campaign for a long, long time. And obviously the Premier League caps its ticket prices for away fans at £30, but there's nothing in the EFL is to the same effect, and some EFL clubs charge well in excess of £30. Is that something that's still sort of ongoing to try and get something further down the pyramid, a price cap?
Oh, absolutely, yes, and exactly as you've said, that there's a great need for it in the Championship. Well, and there's a great need for restrictions on this at every level, because away fans, obviously, in many respects, some of the game's most loyal fans, but also have to spend a lot more to get to the games by and large. So, we'd love to see, and we're still trying to get the Football League to adopt a cap within the Championship as well, and we were very pleased that we were successful at the Premier League level, but it certainly needs to apply at our current level as well.
One thing that may spark the need for a reduced ticketing for away fans is the new EFL TV deal. Well, there's going to be 1,000 matches a year on Sky Sports, and you think that there's going to be, in the Championship, you're looking at half your fixtures being moved for TV. So away followings naturally are probably going to fall off if people can see if Plymouth are at, well, anywhere away from Plymouth, to be fair, it's that far out of the way, and their game's on TV, that, you know, where they may take 1,000 fans, 2,000 fans, that could be reduced by 20%, say, 25%, 30%. So a reduction in ticket prices and a capping, say £20 a ticket, this may be the perfect time to for the FL to actually start listening and bring that in, just to protect the number of away fans that are going to go to games.
Well, yes, if they've got any sense, they will. Because, of course, away fans make a huge contribution to the atmosphere in the ground, which itself is one of the things that is attractive to the broadcasters. So as we saw in COVID, the broadcast product, if I could use that word, suffers a lot when there aren't any fans in the ground, or there aren't two lots of fans cheering and engaging in the various songs. So if the Football League have any sense, they'll recognise that. And as you say, we're going to have some pretty horrendous variations in times that games are on. I think it's quite possible that the effect of this has been a bit underestimated by the Football League. I think there will be many fans who currently enjoy going to, you know, most of the away games and 3 o'clock on a Saturday in particular, who may be far less inclined to go to some of these games at these various kickoff times and on different days. So I agree completely with you. I think if the Football League have any sense, they will make it as easy as possible to keep the away support levels up. And a very significant part of that will be keeping the ticket prices low. It was ironic, wasn't it, that we had, after all I'd said earlier in the discussion about Hull, that we had such good prices at Hull City, of all places.
Yeah. Yes, there's definitely been a change of ownership there, hasn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. So,
I think that, like I say, it's going to be needed. I remember the Stoke playing Millwall many, many years ago when I was a child, and there'd been a bit of, you know, as there was back in the day, a bit of back and forth between the supporters in various sort of meetings prior. And I think Millwall banned Stoke fans from the game at Millwall, the new den, and Stoke reciprocated that and banned Millwall fans. And I remember sitting at that match, and I remember just looking around and thinking, there's no atmosphere at all to this game. I think the home fans felt like there was no need to banter with anyone because there was literally nobody to banter with.
Yes, well, I think that is absolutely the case, isn't it? That a decent away following, or and one that makes a bit of noise, is essential, really, to get the things going in the ground. And I think that if the Football League don't recognise that, they're certainly missing a trick.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's pretty much it from what we were looking to cover, and I think we've been through quite a lot there, and hopefully, you know, I've found it really intriguing and really interesting. Where do you see the future going now? I mean, you've been involved for, like I say, a quarter of a century with things like the FSA and its various guises. What do you think the future holds for football and for football supporters?
Well, hopefully, the new recognition about the importance of fans and the new regulator will help to introduce a culture where fans are at the centre of the game, that it's affordable, that their clubs are sustainable and not at risk of going out of business, and that the key decisions have supporters closely involved in that at every level. At the club level, at the league level, at the FA level. That's the optimistic way. I think we're definitely moving in the right direction. But on the other hand, there are threats and challenges. As we said earlier in the discussion, some concern about the true motivations and understanding of some of the owners now, particularly of the bigger clubs. So complacency would be silly. One of my catchphrases as chair of the FSA is always to say that being right is not enough. We know we're right, but what we have to do is to be effective in changing things that need to be changed and protecting things that need to be protected. And that requires active supporters. So I think the challenge both at Stoke and everywhere in the country is to turn some of that supporter energy, which is sometimes used up in the pub or in the stands with a bit of anger sometimes about this, that or the other, into practical action. So my final message to fellow Stokies is if you feel you can help us in that and you've got skills and energy to do so, then please come forward, either at the Stoke level and or at the national level. There's always plenty of work to be done.
Yeah, well said. And do you want to just reiterate where people can contact you or the best places to get in touch?
Probably the easiest way might be through the FSA website, which is thefsa.org.uk. And there's a facility on there to send a message which would get through to me. Or for those who use the Oatcake message board, you could send me a private message on there. Or if you know what I look like and see me at a game, then by all means, step forward and introduce yourself and say hello. And we can take it from there.
Yeah, brilliant. Anything you want to say, Mike, before we finish?
No, but I'd say, Malcolm, thank you for some really good detail. I mean, I've learned a lot from the back of that, to be honest. And I'm sure there's a lot of people listening that all that was quite new to as well. So, yeah, absolutely. If anyone wants to get involved, you've heard how you can get involved as well. If you're already in the FSA Every Step Along the Way Facebook group, then again, I'm sure you can leave a message on the main page. You can get involved in the Messenger group and leave a message on there. And obviously Malcolm's in that group as well. So either way, you've got like five different ways of getting in touch there. So yeah, but Malcolm, thanks so much for sparing some time. It's been really interesting.
Well, thank you very much. I've certainly greatly enjoyed it. And let us hope that we finish the season with good results at Southampton in the last game at home to Bristol, and that leads us on to challenging at the right end of the table rather than the wrong end of the table next season. So thanks very much.
Yes, thank you as well from me, Malcolm, for going to echo what Mike said. It's been thoroughly enjoyable. And yes, we may see you back on here again at some point.
Any time.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximise your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.